You're listening to SaberCast with Rob Dyer, your home for the deepest insights into baseball featuring guests from throughout the game. SaberCast is a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. For more information about Saber and to check out the show page, visit saber.org. Now, here's Rob Dyer.
And now I'm thrilled to welcome to SaberCast the purveyor, for lack of a better word, of Super 70s sports, Ricky Cobb. Welcome to SaberCast, Ricky.
Rob, thank you for having me on. And I like that, purveyor. It adds a certain gravitas to the nonsense that I do. So thank you for that.
Well, it's funny. Every week, most weeks, I sort of cast about for a guest. And it's almost completely tied to what is on my mind or what I happen to see on Twitter at a particular moment when my brain is in that place. And it never occurred to me to invite you to SaberCast until this week. And all of a sudden, oh yeah, I got to talk to Ricky. It'll be great. Even though you what you do is utterly unlike what anyone else we've had on the show does. So we'll get into that in a minute for those who don't know. But in the beginning, of course, we always start with our three questions. And you mentioned to me before we started a recording that you've never heard the podcast, so these questions should all be a complete surprise to you, which is fun. So, first question, what is your earliest baseball memory?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that is a good question. I don't know if this is actually my first baseball memory, as memories can be deceiving, as you know. You've ran enough tracers to know that our memories play tricks on us. But the one that I think is my first baseball memory is a Cincinnati Reds-Houston Astros game that I saw on television that was in a rain delay. And they were interviewing some of the players. I recall Pete Rose being interviewed. It was a lengthy rain delay. I would have to go back and look the game up, but it was something like 11-9. And I went back and found the box score once several years ago to try and pinpoint when that was. But I think it was a regular season game from 78, probably. But that is at least how I remember it, whether it was my first or not baseball memory.
Now, it's interesting because, well, I should probably wait to get into this a little bit. We're going to come back to the questions, but not having met you in person, although we have spoken before on your podcast, given what you do, I would have guessed that you well remembered a bit more of the 70s than it appears you do. So we'll get into that a little bit later. I just think that's kind of interesting. So my second question, when you were growing up, who was your favorite player?
My favorite player growing up was Reggie Jackson. Again, coming back a little bit to what you were saying just a moment ago, because the first year that I remember baseball is 78. And that's when I fell in love with baseball. I was 6 years old that summer, so kind of a magical age for a kid to discover baseball. And the Yankees were good. And the Yankees were on television more than most teams, because in those days, as you know, we didn't have the Cubs and the Braves being piped through to tens of millions of homes via cable. And so I was a typical front-running kid from Kentucky. I didn't really have a local team. The Reds were really the closest thing I had to a local team. And I was kind of a free agent fan. So I latched on to the Yankees and Reggie Jackson and followed passionately that summer of 1978. And, of course, they won the World Series that year. And Brian Doyle, who was a utility infielder on that team and playing for an injured Willie Randolph in that 78 series. I still remember he went 7-for-16 in that World Series, and it was a huge deal in my little tiny hometown, population of about 2,000. And we actually had a parade for Brian Doyle. I remember standing out in front of my elementary school. I was in second grade and I was holding up a sign that said Brian and Yankees number one. So Reggie Jackson was my guy. When Reggie signed with the Angels in 82 or for the 82 season, I switched my allegiance over to the Angels, and I was an Angels fan for several years. So I actually put Reggie ahead of any team at that point in my young development.
That's great. It's funny that you, and I love the Doyle story. Am I remembering correctly that he actually was on the cover of Sports Illustrated that fall?
Wow, you know, that's a great question. I'm not sure if he was or not, but now you're going to make me go back. First thing when I get off the line with you, I'm going to have to go back and see if he was.
Well, because we have other ways of operating. I can look it up while you were speaking.
Okay, even better.
Yes, there he is, right there on the cover, turning a double play with Lee Lacy sliding into second base.
See, that's pretty heady stuff for a kid from Horse Cave, Kentucky, let me tell you, because I played my Little League games in Brian Doyle Ballpark. So wow. I remember distinctly one day we were playing and the rumor started going around, Brian's here, he's here. And sure enough, he was in the stands. And I think at that time he was in AAA with the Charleston Charlies. And it was still just a huge thing whenever Brian came home because we didn't see him a lot there in the community. So, yeah, Brian Doyle, always a little bit of a special place in my heart. You know, he probably hit about .180 for his career.
Yep. And,
that October, though, he was golden. So,
no, he had that moment. Just like 7 years later, Buddy Biancalana had his moment.
Exactly.
With the 85 Royals.
Very, very similar situation there, yes.
So my third question sometimes is, who is your favorite obscure player? But we'll go with Doyle for that one, and I'll ask you the alternate question, which is, today, all these years later, what's your favorite way to enjoy baseball?
Wow. I still think there's nothing better than beautiful weather and a day at the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
That for me is number one. I still love going out to Wrigley Field, or I travel quite a bit. So going to Dodger Stadium this year, I was actually out in San Francisco for the first time. And of course, Oracle, which I guess is what we call it now, you know, has been talked about so much. And I took a tour there a couple of years ago, but I finally got to see a couple of games there this year. So my first priority is trying to get out to the ballpark as much as I can during the summer. And I like to travel around and get to as many different parks as I can. That's probably my favorite thing.
You know, it's funny. I have the same sorts of feelings. It just occurred to me. I was just yesterday, I'm recording this a few days before this is going to drop, but yesterday I was at the Yankees Mariners game, and just listening to you talk about it, I realized why I enjoy going to the ballpark so much when the weather's nice. It was too hot actually, but once we found some shady seats, just sat there and had the time of my life. And I just realized that it's basically the only time in my life when I allow myself to be lazy. Just sitting there, not really doing anything. I mean, I rarely will sit down and watch even a whole movie on TV. I just can't stand to be sitting in one place for that long. So basically, it's either I'm in bed sleeping or I'm doing something, writing or actively reading, whatever it is, playing, but never just sitting there. So the baseball, when I'm at the ballpark, that's the only time when I feel completely, you know, sort of physically relaxed. And it's still a great feeling. I wish I could do it more often.
Yeah, absolutely. And the weather being nice is a big part of that equation.
Yeah, I was in the direct sunlight in the bleachers for the first three innings, and it became intolerable. But once I found a shady place to sit, I was just so happy.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to games at Wrigley where I've fried in the bleachers, and I've been at even more games at Wrigley where I thought I was going to have hypothermia by the third inning. But but when you've got a really beautiful day, there's still nothing like it to be able to take in the entire field at once and see where all the fielders are positioned and focus in on the little nuances that make baseball so much fun that you can't always pick up on television. I enjoy that part of it a lot too. Plus, there's nothing wrong with having a cold drink and something tasty to eat. So yes. you still can't. Harry Carey was right. You know, you can't beat fun at the old ballpark.
Now, you first came across my radar. I don't remember when. It must have been, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. Well, just briefly, how long has Super 70s Sports existed on Twitter?
Well, the short answer is I created the site on Christmas Eve of 2013. I actually went back and looked that up recently for someone else, and I fiddled around with it, for lack of a better phrase, for a few months, had maybe 500 or 600 followers, stopped doing it for the better part of 2014 because I just had other things going on in my life. And on January the 1st of 2015, I woke up and for some reason thought to myself, what about that Twitter account that you started almost a year ago that's been lying there dormant? Are you going to delete that? Are you ever going to do anything with it? I think I had about maybe 640 followers or something like that. So it was really, really nothing at all of any consequence at that time. And I decided, I'm going to make some tweets. And so I started tweeting every day, and very, very slowly at first, it started to gather a little bit of momentum. And by the end of 2015, I had enough followers and had gained a little bit of notice, and I was pretty well 100% committed to it at that point. So I would say the real birth date of the feed is January 1st, 2015. So I've been at it for a little over 4.5 years.
Now, I have so many questions, and I didn't write them down. I wanted this to sort of be completely spontaneous. In fact, I know there was a lovely, well, I would assume it was lovely, story about you in probably the Chicago newspaper not too long ago.
Yeah, back in February, they did a really wonderful piece on me. I mean, it's almost like I paid them off, but I didn't.
Well,
buddy.
For some reason, I missed it then, and then I ran across it again recently. But I decided, I'm not going to read that. I want to go into this our discussion knowing nothing. So please pardon my ignorance if you've been answering all these questions elsewhere, but I just want to know essentially everything. For example, why the 70s and not the 80s, which would seem to be a little more in your wheelhouse in terms of your memories?
Well, that is a really good question. And the 70s thing, I sort of have mixed feelings about it at this point, because Super 70s Sports has a nice ring to it. I like that. Being the Super 70s guy is become this persona for me, and I've welcomed it with open arms. So I don't have any complaints. Believe me, it's an adventure that I couldn't have anticipated, that I'm on here in my late 40s now, and it's like a dream that has come true in many respects. I really didn't put a lot of thought into what I was naming the account, Rob, because when I started this, it was really just a lark. I'm a college professor by trade. I had been in that career for about 10 or 11 years at the point when I invented this. So I certainly didn't have any ambition for this to the really, honestly, I don't think I ever even considered what it was or what it could eventually be. It was just a place that I could make some jokes. Maybe a few people would see it and find it funny or enjoy the nostalgia or the look back at sports heroes of our youth. And that was really it. And some people get really uptight about the fact that I go outside of the 70s, and they get a little uptight that I'm not covering sports exclusively. And maybe if I had known what it was going to develop into, I would have given it a more generic name that took all the things that I actually do into account. But by the time that it had taken off, I was already named, and it kind of is what it is as far as that goes.
And the great thing from the baseball perspective is that what you do for people who, again, haven't seen it by now, almost everybody listening probably has. And if they haven't, they should go to Twitter, or they should go to the show page, our show page, and look it up. But you marry these delightful images with your delightful one-liners, basically, many of which include F-bombs, which I know we could talk about that a little bit later. By the way, this is an F-bomb friendly zone, at least in moderation. So if it comes up, feel free.
Right.
But I enjoy that little injection of profanity every day myself. I don't use profanity very often at all. I haven't in a long time, not out of principle. I just got out of the habit, because I was in generally places where it wasn't appropriate, working jobs where it wasn't appropriate, having a four-year-old and it wasn't appropriate, but I do appreciate it, and I think it enlivens the humor, as I'm sure you do, or you wouldn't do it. But my point is that what's unique about what you do is you married the images, which are so delightful, with the words, which you come up with. And just to give people a flavor, I'm just looking at the last 8 or 10 of your tweets right now, and very little about baseball. It's all over the map. Here's a rock guitarist. I have to open the picture, so I'm missing who it is. But a rock guitarist. Oh, here we go. Jimi Hendrix and somebody.
Clapton.
And Clapton. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've never seen a picture of Clapton from that long ago. And here's a wrestler named Greg the Hammer Valentine. Then here's a great image of Hank Aaron and Willie Mays, I think from the 60s, actually. Alex Trebek. Grady from Sanford and Son, right in my wheelhouse. Lived on that show when I was a kid. Bobby Knight, Magic Johnson in a giant fur coat. The list goes on and on. The San Diego Conquistadors. So it's more than just baseball. It was everything from the 70s. There was one the other day about the kid's little farm action set.
Yeah, the Fisher Price. Yeah,
Fisher Price. Yes, which is again right in my wheelhouse. Slot hockey, right in my wheelhouse. I mean, you just seem to touch this nerve. Obviously, it's people who grew up in the 70s, like me and you, who can really relate to this stuff. I do wonder, someone who's 30 years old, do they see the slot hockey and go, oh, that is cool. I want to find one of those and see what that's like. I have no idea, but I'm sure you've gained an audience outside just people who were born in the mid and late 60s, or like you and I suppose. But I guess my question is, I've always wondered, where in the hell do you get the images? I mean, I know where you can get them, but what makes you think, oh, I think I'll post something about the Conquistadors now? Where does this come from?
Sometimes I don't even know myself, to tell you the truth. It's the way my mind works, I suppose. I obviously developed somewhere along the way a real appreciation for 70s and 80s pop culture, and obviously sports, because I was a hardcore sports fan from the time that I was pretty much old enough to walk around and form an opinion about things. So that was a natural for me, the sports side of it. And then I really realized through administering this account how much information I picked up about other stuff. And I think the thing that has been really interesting for me in terms of kind of the impact, if you will, that this Twitter account has made with people that I couldn't have ever really seen coming, is just the power of collective reflection, the power of nostalgia, the power of just throwing up a picture of a lunchbox or a Fisher Price toy or the team pencils with NFL team names written on them that a lot of us used at school when we were little kids. It can be any of these things, and they have a way of sparking a fire for people and igniting memories and bringing back good feelings. And I never realized the strength of that, and I never realized the power of tapping into sort of that collective consciousness. And that's been a really gratifying part of this for me. And you know, you asked me earlier why the 70s and not the 80s, and I think I unintentionally dodged that question. So to go back to that, I have a real fascination for the 70s, and not to go super serious on you here, but my dad passed away in 1976 in a car accident. He was a county sheriff and was involved in a high-speed chase and passed away the day after my 5th birthday, actually, because I was born in 71. So I'm a little bit younger than people think that I am sometimes. and I think probably to really give it a serious answer, to some degree, losing my dad in the mid-70s probably created a sort of fascination for me with what was life like when my dad was still around. And probably to some degree, I became fascinated with the 60s as well, but really into the early and mid-70s, just because, you know, I was just imagining, well, you know, what was that world that my dad existed in like? And so that's probably part of the picture. But as you note, I post a lot of 80s stuff as well.
Right.
You know, and although people push back on that a little bit, it's, I think the audience for the most part kind of understands what it is that I do now. And if somebody comes along and says, hey, this picture's from 1982 or whatever, most of the time I don't even have to say anything anymore because my audience will interject and say, uh-oh, you're new around here, aren't you? You know, that sort of deal. So, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, from before I was born all the way up through my teen years and even into young adulthood, you know, there's always some kind of material to go out there and look for and try to find that may be able to entertain people. As far as where I find it, it's really just a matter of making my mind up to dig through lots and lots and lots of images on the internet. And I liken it to fishing. Some days you go fishing and you clean up and you go home and you're frying up fish and having a big dinner. And then there's other days that you go fishing and you come home empty handed. And in searching for really good visual content on the internet is kind of like that. It's one of those deals where I might invest 2 or 3 hours of time and come away with one usable picture, or I might get lucky and find a dozen. So that can be frustrating sometimes when it doesn't work out great. But when I find something really good, I'm so happy because I think to myself, oh my gosh, people are going to love this and I can't wait to put it out there.
Well, can you talk us through the process for one at least? There's one from yesterday, actually, with 5 Montreal Expos. Can you sort of just go through the process of how you arrived at the idea for posting that image and then going through the whole process of coming up with the right words to go with it?
Sure. You know, that tweet is, first of all, it's an example of how much I love the Montreal Expos organization and pine for it to exist again. And whether that's at the expense of the Tampa Bay Rays or some other organization, I don't wish ill will on anybody. I have friends in the Tampa Bay Rays organization, and I certainly would not be happy to see anybody's life upended, and particularly this silly idea of playing in both St. Petersburg and in Montreal. But the Montreal Expos are one of my favorite teams ever. And so I have a lot of fun posting about them. And I've certainly made a lot of friends in Canada. Some people tell me that I'm an honorary Canadian. I don't think that I haven't consulted with Trudeau yet about that. I don't think it has any teeth, but it's kind of nice for people to say that. I love so many of the players. I think that photo that you're referring to was Gary Carter, Dawson, Raines, Cromartie, and Oliver, perhaps, who are all names from my youth that I have so much respect for and enjoyed watching those guys play. And since my love for the Expos is pretty well established, I just reflected back on the fact that I saw the Montreal Expos play a couple of times when I was a kid. And since I'm one of their more vocal proponents, I thought that it was kind of nice that they happened to win both times that I saw them play. So I just threw it in there that the Montreal Expos were undefeated when I was in the house, as though I had anything at all to do with that. But that was kind of the angle there.
Well, and then coincidentally or not, I don't know, you posted not long after that tweet a link to purchase Montreal Expos apparel. How did that all come about? And how does that fit in with the other things that you're doing?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where in the beginning, this was entirely a hobby. About a year into it, I was approached by an apparel company in New York called Streaker Sports, and they gave me the idea of, what would you say if you promoted some type of throwback clothing item that matches the spirit of your what you're doing, and you know, basically you could monetize what you're doing a little bit. And I thought, well, that sounds great. And so I did that, and later on, as time has gone on, other companies have reached out to me and wanted to work with me as my audience has expanded and the reach has gotten a little greater. And so I work with Fanatics as well as Topps baseball cards now. There's a clothing company, Homage, that some of your listeners may have heard of, based out of Columbus, Ohio. I work with them. And perhaps most importantly of all, I'm currently developing the Super 70 Sports apparel brand, which is going to launch, fingers crossed and toes crossed and knocking on wood, because starting up an apparel company, I have learned, is a lot more complicated than I might have imagined. But we're probably a few weeks away, as you and I tape this in late August, from launching that brand. So it is certainly become a business as well as a passion, and it's something that I'm hoping I can branch off perhaps into television or streaming content and things of that nature as well.
Well, gee, I hope that works out for you, because I think there, for me, I'm always on the lookout for new stuff, and there's still some space. I'm always thinking of shirts I wish existed that somehow, even with all these companies that are doing really neat stuff, things, it's they're still not making that thing. So I'm sure you've got some great ideas. I'm looking forward to that. Speaking of other things, though, you were, I didn't realize until just a minute ago when I checked, that you're no longer really, apparently, in the podcast space, but you did some great podcasts up through last year anyway, and just sort of wondering about your experience doing that and why you've stopped, assuming that you have stopped.
Well, the podcast is, I won't say the podcast is dead. It's on hiatus, would probably be how I would characterize it. And really just a matter of time allocation. As I've gotten further and further into the world of Super 70 Sports, it becomes more time consuming, both in terms of generating the content and you know, as far as the content goes, the larger the audience gets, I feel that much more compelled to try and give them my A game every day. I don't think that you spend the time and grind through tweeting every day for almost 5 years to build a Twitter account that has close to 300,000 followers to start slacking off now, you know. So I'm trying to dial it up and bring the best quality tweets that I can bring every day. And I may not always succeed, but that's the goal, certainly. And so to be in the position that I'm in now, with that being very important to me, as well as trying to get a clothing brand off the ground. In fact, two clothing brands, because I have another brand that I'm partnering on with my friend Chad Lowe, and we're working on that. And so you start working on the back end, you start working on the front end. Then, of course, I'm still a college professor. And I have five kids and two stepkids and a granddaughter. And so the podcast has sort of been shuffled to the back burner a little bit in 2019, more so than perhaps I would like to ideally. But it's really just more attributable to the fact that I'm kind of a one-man operation here. My wife is certainly very, very helpful and works with me on the business side of things. But still, it's a lot of time that it takes to do this, and I really need a staff. So if anybody wants to be my unpaid intern, they can always send their applications to me via Twitter, and maybe that'll get the podcast out there a little more frequently again.
I'm fairly sure that there will be some people who would like that job. And just for people who haven't listened to the podcast, you got some fantastic guests. You had Rob Lowe on the podcast. Yeah. You had early on, you had Ellis Valentine, Dale Murphy, John DeCisto. I'm just looking at the baseball stars, Billy Sample, Mike Norris, Brett Boone. I mean, the list goes on. You got some fantastic guests. One thing I wondered early on, when I didn't really know anything about you, was how did this guy get such great guests when not many people have heard of you yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I have had some good guests. I've had Dave Parker on and Alan Trammell, basketball players. I've had George McGinnis and Dan Issel. Dale Earnhardt Jr. has been on the podcast, for crying out loud. Barry Williams from the Brady Bunch.
And you had me one, believe it or not, one time.
You have been on the podcast twice, my friend. That's right. Yeah. So I'm very flattered to be on your podcast because you were a guest that I was really happy to land. So, it's one of those things where you've just got to ask. The answer is always no if you don't ask. And I became acquainted with some of the baseball players. I have a book that's in development that is taking forever that my wife, I think, is pretty convinced that I'm never going to finish. With some good reason, but I'm working on an oral history project that unfortunately is kind of lumped in with the podcast right now. I think it's kind of just been something that I haven't been able to get to much this year. But I've interviewed over 100 players for this book, and I got to know some of the people that have been on the podcast through interviewing them for the book. So that was sort of my entry point for getting Ellis on, as well as Mike Norris and Johnny D and some of those guys that you mentioned. And the rest of it, a lot of it has happened through Twitter. Rob Lowe has been following me on Twitter since very early on. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. has been another guy who's been really supportive of what I do on Twitter and has been following me for several years now. And so I think once people kind of have a little bit of a frame of reference of who I am, that makes it easier to land a guest rather than just completely cold calling somebody, which I really hate to do.
So let me just ask you the impossible question, which is to give us a couple of your favorite guests or maybe your favorite moments from all those interviews with the sports stars.
Oh, wow. As far as favorite guests go, I'm always afraid that I'm gonna leave somebody's name out. But some of the ones that come to mind, I mean, certainly Rob Lowe was a great name to land. And I'm pleased to say that he was also just an outstanding guest because he got it. He understood the account. He found it funny, and so it was a really fun conversation talking to him. He wasn't only a big name, but he was actually one of the more entertaining guests that I've had. I really enjoyed having Barry Williams from the Brady Bunch on, Greg Brady. So that was kind of a bucket list interview for me, just to be able to pick his mind about any silly question that I happen to have about the Brady Bunch.
And let me break in for a second.
Yeah,
one of my, I don't think I've told this story on the podcast. In fact, I'm sure that I haven't. One of my favorite moments of my entire career, I happened to be doing color on the radio for a Portland Beavers game 10, 15 years ago. And it happened to be Leave It to Beaver bobblehead night. And Jerry Mathers was at the ballpark. He came on the air, and my partner, Rich Burke, who was doing play-by-play, he basically handed the interview over to me, and I got to just ask Jerry Mathers whatever I wanted for 5 or 10 minutes. And it was, to this day, it's one of the favorite things I've ever done. And I've gotten to do a lot of amazing things, as people might guess, but getting to sit within like literally 4 inches from Jerry Mathers and ask him about being the Beaver and working with Alfred Hitchcock, that was better than any moment I've ever had with a sports figure. It was incredible.
Right? I can't imagine how amazing it would be to just show up at the ballpark and like, oh, by the way, an interview with the Beaver falls into your lap. I think that there's something about those television personalities, particularly from that era when we only had a few channels and those shows were really, really iconic. And there's something about that where with athletes, yes, when I was a kid, I looked up to athletes in much the same way that people look up to Hollywood figures. But as you get older, and particularly for guys like myself and more so for you, who have worked in the industry covering sports figures, that maybe kind of wears off a little bit quicker than it wears off, these people that are on our television every week or every day in syndication. So yeah, I mean, Jerry Mathers or Barry Williams, it just seems like those are people that we should never have access to. And when you get access, it's a golden opportunity and you don't want to blow it.
Yeah. Those characters, not the people, but the characters, Bob Newhart on the original Bob Newhart show is another great example. The guys on Emergency, we could go on and on about this stuff.
But yes, we could.
Those characters burrowed their ways into my mind like no sports figures did. I mean, the sports figures, I adored them too and wanted to get George Brett's autograph and all the rest of his teammates. But there was something about those guys I watched on TV every week, or in some cases every day because they were in syndication and I was coming home from school and watching whatever show it was, that is just unmatched by any sports figure or movie star, or whatever. These were characters that were in my brain, part of my life. And so, yeah, I mean, to any of those guys, I would just be, that's when my jaw would drop for that sort of thing. Not me. If I met George Brett today, it'd be cool. I'm going to talk to George Brett about baseball. This will be really fun. But if I met Randy Mantooth, forget about it.
Oh, are you kidding me? See, those guys, I think the nature of television, and as you know correctly, I think the fact that it's the character that's so important, right? Barry Williams is a great guy, a super nice guy and a talented guy, and it was a pleasure to talk to him. But there is this mind trip going on where you're thinking to yourself, this is Greg Brady.
Right.
And much the same thing. Like if you're talking to Randolph Mantooth, that's Johnny Gage, man.
Yep.
You know, I'm talking to Johnny Gage. And those characters are just perpetually frozen in our youth.
Right.
You know, Randolph Mantooth got old, but Johnny Gage never did. Johnny Gage is still out there at Station 51. And when that rerun comes on or you pull it up on some streaming service, you are right back in 1974 or whatever. And Johnny Gage is 30 years old and there is somebody that needs Ringer's lactate and there's a desperate situation. And I think that's the difference in some ways. George Brett, yeah. I mean, we can go back to the 70s and 80s and think about him chasing 400 in 1980 and, you know, remember when he hit the home run off of Gossage in the ALCS. And that stuff is, you know, forever belongs to the 70s and the 80s. But you know, George Brett is here today, too.
Yeah, and right? We watched him age.
Right.
We watched him as he played into his late 30s, I think maybe even early 40s. And then we've watched him since then go into the Hall of Fame when he was 46 or whatever it was. And then, you know what I mean? Like, we've seen him progress to be a normally aging person. Whereas, frankly, we haven't seen Randolph Mantooth very often. But even if we did, it wouldn't be, as a sports fan, it wouldn't be on a regular basis.
Right.
Basically, the Randy Mantooth that I see in my head is only the one from 1975, which connotes a sort of godlike status because he's immortal, essentially.
Right. I mean, I'm talking, Barry Williams is probably in his early 60s.
Yep.
And I'm speaking to him for the interview. And of course, we're on the phone and I'm listening to that familiar voice.
Yep, he sounds exactly the same.
He sounds exactly the same. And so I'm imagining Greg Brady on the other end of the line. Like he's just gotten home from high school and he's calling me from the den there on the on the Brady's old cord phone, you know? Yeah, it's strange how we sort of compartmentalize these characters and these figures in unique ways.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I'll go back to sports after this, but one thing you do notice as an adult when you go back and watch those old shows is just how terrible most of them were.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like to watch an episode of The Brady Bunch now, the only way you can enjoy it is as pure camp and nostalgia because everything else about it is just utterly childish.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is interesting about this whole nostalgia thing is the fact that sometimes we remember stuff for whatever reason, and I'm a cynical son of a bitch a lot of the time, but I remember a lot of this old 70s and 80s stuff through rose-colored glasses. It's like the Atari 2600. the old original Atari. I have such affection for remembering when I got one of those, or going over to my friend's house and they had an Atari and my friend had a bunch of games that I didn't have. And oh my gosh, we're going to get to play Breakout or whatever the game was that he had. But you go back, and if you have the opportunity to actually see some of those Atari 2600 games now, they're just awful.
Yes.
And I'm remembering it from 35 or more years ago as being this really, really fun thing. And I guess it was at the time, but you go back and revisit some of it and it's not so hot. And one other thing that I think of as you say that is I had Nick Bakay, the comedian and producer, on the show a couple of times. And we were talking about something similar to what you and I are discussing. And one of us brought up Laverne and Shirley. And we were basically just kind of looking at Laverne and Shirley and thinking to ourselves, like, why do we both know so much about Laverne and Shirley? Because we realized as we spoke and the conversation went on that neither one of us really loved it all that much. It was okay. But for a show that was just okay, we both sure did know a lot about it. And it was because we were living in an era where you picked the best thing out of three or four that were on TV, and that's what you were going to watch.
Right.
And so we had this shared experience that I think is lost in some ways in modern society, especially in terms of television, because most of us now, we're watching our favorite programs streaming, or we've DVR'd it, or whatever the case may be. And there are so many different options, which is great for the consumer, even though a lot of the options are, you know, it's kind of like 100 channels and nothing's on, that sort of thing. They're not always the greatest, but it's very fractured now, so that somebody else's favorite show could be a show that not only have I never seen it, I may not have even ever heard of it. Whereas that really didn't exist very much. You had to be living under a rock in the 70s if you didn't know what Laverne and Shirley was.
Well, that's right. They were on the cover of magazines, TV Guide. It was the highest rated show on television for two or three seasons, I think, at least. It passed Happy Days early in its run, as I recall, and was there for a few years. And then, of course, ultimately it jumped the shark when they moved to California. But it was an incredibly successful show, and everybody watched it. And that just, as you say, it doesn't exist. There is no show like that. There is no show that has that sort of reach at this point. Not Game
right.
of Thrones, not anything. You're absolutely right that we've certainly lost something. We lost that shared experience. And of course, it extends to sports as well, because when we were growing up, everybody wasn't a baseball fan. But everybody knew who Reggie Jackson was. Everybody.
That's right.
Because he was everywhere. He was on talk shows. He was on the covers of magazines. He was in TV commercials. I'm sure he did any number of guest spots on sitcoms. And there just aren't players like that anymore. The only the only thing you can really compare him to today would probably be LeBron James, maybe one or two other basketball players. But that's it.
Yeah.
We certainly have lost that shared experience, which, look, I think as a society, it's a loss. As individuals, we've gained way more than we've lost because we have so many great choices now. There are way more great TV shows than I could possibly ever watch, and that's fantastic. But that's good for me. I don't think it's good for our society for everybody to be off doing different things.
I feel much the same way, and I think you make a really good point there. I feel much the same way about being a sports fan at times. There was, and again, this is the best time ever to be a sports fan in the sense that you can see any Major League Baseball game that you want, right? If you really are committed, you can watch any NFL football game that you want, or NBA game, or NHL game, or whatever your thing is. It is out there, and you can pay a reasonable amount of money, and then you can consume that. Whereas when we were kids, I don't know, I don't know what the television selection was like where you were at. Maybe you were getting Royals games or something like that. But for myself, it was basically you might get a Cincinnati Reds game or two a week, and probably at most. And then other than that, you were relying on Monday Night Baseball or the game of the week
right.
on the weekend. You know, the NBC game of the week. I mean, my goodness, that was appointment television, you know? I mean, it was leave me alone. The Phillies are playing the Mets today at Veterans Stadium, and Vin and Joe are there, and I am going to sit down today for about 3 or 4 hours, and that's what I'm going to do, you know? And I think maybe our generation has lost that understanding, sort of how special it was to us, and that sometimes something being readily available perhaps causes us to not appreciate it as much as we otherwise would. Now, I agree with you. I wouldn't want to go back to two baseball games a week being available, no matter how much I would right. appreciate them. But something's lost sometimes when other things are gained.
Oh, no question. And I think, that's obviously the mature adult way to look at the world, right?
Progress is things change and they don't all change in the same direction. So you just have to weigh it out at the end and say, are things overall better today than they were? And the Super 70s guy, I probably shouldn't weigh in on that, or people may turn on me, because I think everybody thinks that deep in my heart, I want shag carpet and one of those 9,000-pound televisions sitting right. in the living room. But the fact is, Super 70 sports couldn't really have existed, at least not in anything approaching the same manner, in the 1970s, because I'm relying on all of our wonderful modern technology to be able to put these jokes and pictures out there for you guys.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So speaking of jokes, I can't let you get away without this question. I wish I had practiced, but I didn't practice my church lady voice, but Ricky, the profanity, do we really need all the profanity?
Well, that is one of the things that people do say to me, and I get that fairly often. Usually, hardly ever a week goes by that someone doesn't make some sort of observation about it. I have had people email me asking me if I could just stop cursing so much. Very not usually really nice. Nobody sends an email and says, hey, you've got a filthy mouth, you scumbag, you know. But people will email me sometimes and say, I love your account, the pictures are great, it's very funny, but I can't show it to my kids, or I can't share it with people, or I don't feel comfortable retweeting this, or whatever. Don't you think that you'd be just as funny if you didn't use that language, you know? And the answer, if people ask me in private, the answer, I try to give a sincere answer to a sincere question, and I'll just tell them something along the lines of, I'm just doing what I think is funny. The entire thing with the Twitter account, it's very personal for me, so I'm just trying to make the Twitter account that I would want to read yep. if I wasn't the one that was doing it.
That's
right?
All you can do.
As cliche as that is, that's what I'm doing, and I'm trying to be true to myself, and that's how I talk. If you know me, of course the Twitter account is a little bit of showbiz. I tell people that the Twitter account is just my real personality turned up to full volume. So if as I sit here talking to you right now, this is just kind of me when I'm at a 7, the Twitter account is me just turning the dial a few notches to the right. But it is me.
You know, it's funny because I don't have a lot of patience with people who make complaints like that, because they're not doing it. And I will say that I would say once a week, even for me, you cross the line a little bit. But if you weren't crossing the line, that you wouldn't be going far enough. If you know what I mean? It's like any comedian. I just watched Dave Chappelle's special, his latest. And there was a moment or two or three when I thought, oh, man, really? I don't know, Dave. But that's his job. He's supposed to push me to the edge sometimes. And
right.
you can't push everybody right to the edge and stop. Some of those people are going to go past the edge. And that's just part of it.
And the thing that's interesting about that is the one or two times a week that I kind of cross like wherever your boundary is, that might be hitting the absolute sweet spot of comedy for somebody else.
Absolutely.
Whereas the joke that you laughed your butt off at the day before, that same exact person might have kind of been cringing a little bit on that one.
Exactly.
You know, so you never know. But the point you make is really true. I don't try to be edgy for the sake of being edgy. There's a lot of that in contemporary media and particularly in sports, the sort of the industry of false confrontation and embraced debate and, you know, the whole Skip Bayless world that's out there. I never try to be edgy for the sake of being edgy, but I do have the kind of sense of humor where I don't really believe in sacred cows very much.
Right.
And I think that you can mine comedy from lots of places that aren't politically correct necessarily and aren't necessarily things that people are comfortable talking about.
Right.
But I think that things can get really boring really fast if you're afraid to go up to the line. And sometimes I think you even have to step over the line just to kind of reestablish where the line actually is.
Yep.
And I've crossed the line even for myself a few times. I have occasionally tweeted something and looked at it, and I won't say what this is, but I tweeted something not long ago and I deleted it pretty quickly afterwards. It wasn't anything that was terrible, but I kind of just thought to myself, maybe that's just a hair past even where I want to go, you know, because I never want to hurt anybody's feelings. I never want to tweet anything that anybody could potentially take personally or as an indictment of who they are or who people like them are. I never, ever want to do that. And I try to be an equal opportunity smartass.
Right.
I will make fun of your team. I will make fun of your favorite player. I will make fun of this. I'll make fun of that. But if you just stick with me, I'm going to cycle all the way around the spectrum, taking my little jokes at everybody. And unless we're talking about somebody like O.J. Simpson or somebody that is truly loathsome and deserves to get picked on, the jokes are almost always tongue-in-cheek, and I'm just having some lighthearted fun with it. Even if I am using profanity, it's usually done with a wink and a nod.
Well, this is great, buddy. I wish you luck with the clothing.
Thank you. I hope
you bring the podcast back. And when we get together, I'll bring the quarters for slot hockey.
Okay, you're on. But we got to at least go like 2 out of 3.
Sure, 2 out of 3.
Okay.
Hey, 3 out of 5. I'll play as long as you want to play.
Okay, you're on. It could be a 7-game series.
Okay.
Even that way, you know, even if you sweep me, that means I get to play 4 times. And we are all winners when we play slot hockey.
Absolutely. Take care, buddy. That was fun.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
And I am thrilled, as always, to welcome Scott Busch back to SaberCast. I always feel funny saying that because it sort of feels like it's me and Saber, as if Scott were some sort of odd guest from another planet. But no, Scott is the CEO of Saber, so Scott belongs here more than I do. Hi, Scott.
I'm more of a quirky sidekick, I think. at least that's my preferred element. Happy Labor Day to all, and happy Glaber Day to those who celebrate, Rob.
Yes, absolutely. This gives me a chance to get a little dig in at Major League Baseball, which seems to have absolutely no idea what Labor Day is about.
Well, I think they know that it's about a holiday for most people who then should try to come to a game.
They do know that, which
I think is totally appropriate. It's not as much of a family holiday as many other holidays are.
Well, yes, but this is a longer thing. We should get to this another time maybe, but it's one of those things that sort of bugs me every year. But so we're both away from our usual equipment. So if this sounds different to people, that's why. Please indulge us. On Vashon Island in Puget Sound, one of my favorite places in the whole world, for the weekend with my family. And you're also away.
That's right. I am in a place where very few people can find in Southwest Minnesota, by design, of course, and thrilled to be here.
not that far from the Field of Dreams, as I recall my geography. And we still need to get together sometime and have a special episode on all the places baseball should play someday.
That's right. That's right. We will convene that special episode at some point.
At some point when we are more settled, and I'm getting there. I'm working on it. I thought once my season was over in the West Coast League, I would immediately lapse into lolling about on the couch, reading books, and learning how to play the guitar, all those sorts of things. But it hasn't happened yet.
Right on. Well, it will. It will. We will get there. I promise. We'll I promise so. Everyone, right? Yes. I promise. Well, but we, you know, the weekend technically not complete because we've got a holiday today, but we'll go ahead and declare some winners, I think. Who won the weekend for you, Rob?
You know, I wasn't really dialed into this story, but I think you have to go with Carlos Carrasco, right? I mean, I didn't realize you could be diagnosed with leukemia in June and then pitch in September. I didn't even think that was possible. And yet there he was. So obviously a tremendous story.
Yeah. Just amazing to see and really great to see how everyone throughout the game reacted to it. You know, I think just across the board, a feel good moment for everybody. And he was also my winner. So now we've got to fill time, I think.
Well, okay. How about this? It was his weekend, obviously, but I'm still sort of stunned that the Indians are where they are after their early start. And one of the reasons they were supposed to win this season was because their starting pitching was so fantastic, and
right.
Including Trevor Bauer and Carlos Carrasco, and of course Carrasco. Is not having the season people expected. Is 4-6 this year, and they traded Trevor Bauer, and yet here they are still. Now they've fallen behind the Twins a little bit, but they're still obviously on track to make the playoffs. So it's and there are stories like that all over baseball. Teams that were expected to do something and have done it, but did it in wildly strange ways. And the Yankees maybe being the best example, who I saw last week, by the way. In Seattle.
Very good. You got a Yankee game, man. That's great to hear.
I got a Yankee game. I have this, unlike you, I have a love-hate relationship with the Yankees. Actually, it's more of a hate-love relationship. I still have that vestigial, to some degree, feelings of hatred for them because of what they did to my favorite team in the 1970s. But I still find myself attracted to them. Attracted to them because of the history that they obviously bring to the table in every right. single game. So I was just fortunate. They had a day game in Seattle last week, and it was turned out to be a good time to drive up in the morning and then drive home at night. I wish the game had been more competitive. The Yankees bludgeoned the Mariners 8-2 or something, but still good to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting back to the Indians real quick, still beset a little bit by injuries. You know, Kluber has missed quite a bit of time. Ramirez is now on the injured list. And Tyler Naquin recently tore his ACL, unfortunately, and is done for the year. And so I think, as great of a year as they've had and as resilient as they've shown themselves to be, I think a little bit of a dogfight here down the stretch, particularly with the A's picking it up and setting their sights on a wild card. So it's going to be interesting. We've got some really good baseball in front of us this last month or so, trying to figure out who those AL wild card teams are going to be.
No, it's a good point. And really, the Indians are by no means a sure thing because they're essentially tied with the Rays and almost exactly tied with the A's. And the Rays at this point, and obviously most likely only two of those three teams are going to wind up in the playoffs. So sure, it's going to be tough. That's really one of the few really interesting things to watch down the stretch is the fight for the wild cards in the American League. And the same thing in the National League. I was 24 hours ago, I was prepared to name the Cardinals as the winner of the weekend, but they didn't quite get in there far enough. If they had been able to win, sweep both doubleheaders, over the weekend, they would now have a 4-game lead over the Cubs, which is pretty comfortable in early September.
Yeah.
And right. You know, look, three is nice too, but 4 would have been obviously even a touch better. And they've been a good story too, because they, like the Indians, were sort of given up for dead back in May or June. And here they are in great position for at worst a wild card, but certainly they're looking pretty good for the division title.
That's right. And before we move on, though, we would be remiss if we did not mention the fact that Justin Verlander threw his 3rd career no-hitter last night.
Yes,
and did it in the most Verlander way possible by throwing more pitches than most people throw anymore and throwing it at a higher velocity at the end than he did at the start, which is just his entire career in a microcosm. And it's really, really great that we've been so fortunate to be able to enjoy him during his career.
Well, it is his entire career, except for that little blip, right?
Right.
In 2016, and especially 2017, before he went to the Astros. And his record since joining the Astros is 38-14. Pretty phenomenal thing. And a lot of that, most of that is Verlander, but some of that is certainly the Astros and pitching coach Brent Strom. Because I think that he wasn't an all-star in 2014, 2015, 2016, or 2017 after having been one for 5 straight seasons. And,
right.
And now he's been an all-star again at 35 and 36, these last 2 seasons, and is probably going to lead the league in starts both seasons, lead the league in strikeouts both seasons. It's just, look, people are said, it always bugs me when someone like Verlander does something specific, like throw a no-hitter, a 3rd no-hitter, and people say, now he's really in the Hall of Fame. Well, he was already in the Hall of Fame. You can't go from being in the Hall of Fame to in the Hall of Fame more. You're already in.
It's a binary situation.
Yes, it's at some point it becomes that. Yeah, and it became that for him probably a year or two ago. Probably when the Astros won the World Series and he was so instrumental. That might have already, although that he didn't have 200 wins at that point, but he was already there. This season put him over the top, no question. The no-hitter really doesn't have anything to do with it. At some point, we get to start talking about not whether he's in the Hall of Fame, but we start talking about where he is on the list of all-time pitchers. And I don't really do that sort of work anymore. I used to do it all the time, like every day.
Right.
But that's going to be an interesting conversation when you look at his record and his postseason performance, which has been quite good, not quite as good as regular season, but still fantastic. And he's been instrumental in some big playoff pushes. So that's going to be a fun conversation. But the really interesting thing about Verlander is we don't even seem to be near the end of that conversation, because barring a catastrophic injury, which he's never had,
right,
he could pitch another 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. I wouldn't put it past him and pile up some truly impressive numbers.
Yeah, he's going to have the opportunity to start to set some benchmarks for modern pitchers in terms of career accumulation, whether it's strikeouts, wins, etc. That many players, based on how the game is played today, are not going to have the opportunity or ability to reach or surpass. And I think that, you know, he will become a benchmark of sorts for many, many years to come if he's able to continue to play at a high level for several seasons like we're talking about. It's really interesting.
Right, right. And we don't really know what the limits are for a pitcher like Verlander, who is able to stay healthy and pitch into his early 40s. I mean, I guess Clemens and Nolan Ryan. By the way, I had to mention this because it really bothered me. I was listening to the game on the radio, and one of the Blue Jays broadcasters referred to the Nolan Express. Maybe it's because I'm this old, but that's not a nickname.
That's not correct. No.
It's the whole point of the nickname was because there was a movie called Von Ryan's Express. right? So Nolan Express doesn't mean anything. That's a completely made up thing that only someone who doesn't know anything about movie or baseball history would say. So, okay, I got that out. Now I can let it go.
So have you been reading anything such as the etymology of the Ryan Express in the last week?
I'm reading a book about the semicolon, which I think is essential for every writer to use and to read about. I'm reading a book about publishing because I don't feel like I know enough about that subject. But on the baseball front, actually, I'm now devoting these next few days, including today, to catching up on tweets, believe it or not, because I'm constantly saving tweets and then not reading the actual articles they link to. Do you do that?
I do not.
It's a sickness. It really is. It's just another way to procrastinate. Yes, I want to read that. No, I don't want to read it now. And part of it is I look at a screen so much anyway that reading articles on my screen, I think subconsciously, I sort of shy away from. But there are two Twitter accounts that are consistently linking to articles that I think I need to read. One of them is called Umpire Ejections. And I'm not sure who maintains this feed. Somebody involved with umpiring, though, because they're hyper-technical. But they analyze every single player or coach ejection or manager ejection. Mm-hmm. And if it's based on balls and strikes, and most of them are, they go look at the data to see if the pitch that got the player or coach so upset was a strike or a ball. So, you know, as a commissioner of a league, I love that kind of stuff. It's just so nutsy and boltsy that I can't get enough of it. And then the other one, of course, and I don't even think we talked about this, but Sabres Baseball Cards blog is wildly entertaining, and I just want to read every single thing that gets posted. I've saved many of them in the last week or so, and I want to catch up on all of those because I enjoyed every single post. And I actually posted two or three pieces when it first started as a favor to Mark Armour, but I need to get back into that. Maybe this winter I'll try to do a couple because I always think I want to write more about baseball cards and I don't do it. So those are the two things that I'm reading baseball wise lately.
Yeah. Well, and that's great. And the, for those that have not experienced the Sabre Baseball Cards Committee, you can find them on both Twitter and Facebook, but they also have a blog where they update from time to time. And they've got several members of the committee that are quite active and they've done a wonderful job of building a community outside of Sabre membership. There's quite a few people who engage with that group on social media and just talk baseball cards, right? So if that's an aspect of the game that you enjoy, they're definitely worth checking out.
We've always wanted to do that in Sabre. We've always known that there are only a few thousand of us who are actually members, but there are millions of fans who would enjoy at least some of the things that we do. And this is a great example of that.
Yeah, they're really, really brilliant. It's great stuff. And I enjoy it. I don't ever have, a challenge of the job for me is finding the time to figure out how to spend my time. And I would love to spend more time on the outputs of that group when I can find the ability to do it. So it's a lot of fun. And I would encourage folks to check it out.
Really good stuff. I can happily report that I have our next two podcast guests lined up.
How about that? So we're going to be able to make an early announcement or are we going to save it?
No, I think we'll make it. I want to tease it a little bit.
Very good.
I guess maybe because I'm just so excited about not having to think about it every week. Most weeks I sort of struggle which of the amazing people that I know would be great to have on the show this week. But the next two are lined up because we had them lined up for weeks. Next week, Jacob Pomerenke and I will talk about the Black Sox and preview the amazing symposium that Jacob's going to be hosting, I believe, in Chicago, right?
That's right.
So that's going to be a ton of fun for me because I get to learn new stuff. And then the week after that, Jane Levy's the paperback edition of her fantastic Babe Ruth book is going to be released. I'm going to get Jane on the phone and talk about not only the Babe, but also Mickey Mantle and Sandy Koufax and whatever else she wants to talk about. So those two should be a lot of fun for me at the very least.
Awesome. Those are going to be great.
Scott, thank you for joining from South West Minnesota. Is that right? Did I get the corner right?
That's right. Southwest.
I looked it up on a map one time.
I call it East Dakota. So, Southwest Minnesota, East Dakota. It's all the same.
Always puts me in mind of the movie Fargo and my time as a child living in Fargo, which are two completely different things. But that's my basic experience with that part of the country. All right. Good talking to you, buddy. We'll talk next week.
Great to catch up. Thanks, Rob.
All right. See ya.
This has been SaberCast with Rob Dyer, a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. You can find Saber on Twitter and Facebook and find even more baseball research, previous episodes of SaberCast, bonus content from this episode, and a list of what Rob's reading at saber.org. Music for SaberCast is provided by The Baseball Project.